Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you, Ellie, for those very kind remarks. And I want to thank Wickedy for hosting this and for the Madison Tag Group for hosting, to Lori Frost and Jenny Root for doing everything to make this such a very special day for me. I've talked to lots of wonderful people. I've shared lots of ideas. I've stretched some thinking, I think, a little bit. And I wanted to share some ideas with all of you this evening. So I'm going to start right now with my little presentation. I feel like being a renowned gifted educator might be a bit of a stretch. So I wanted to give you a background, a little bit of background of who I am, because I don't feel I should be considered a renowned gifted educator. I just got into the gifted education business, philanthropy, in the last 6.5 years. We've been doing it. I've been studying gifted education for the last 8 years and doing research on what we could do to make a difference. So I haven't formally studied at any university on gifted education. My PhD is in American Studies, which is basically a double major in American history and American English. And that was a long, long time ago when I was a very young person, and I've forgotten most of that since then. But I spent the first 15 years of my career as a teacher, as a college professor. I always, though, I've always felt in myself as a teacher, because I've always been interested in education. I started tutoring very young, and I actually started getting paid for it at 75 cents an hour. When I was 13, I started tutoring in the basement of my Indiana home, and that was really big money back then. That was several years ago, too. And so I continued tutoring because I just loved tutoring. I loved trying to figure out how to get to reach each child and how to explain it or how to help that child have those aha moments. And I did that until I was 40, and then I just got so busy with my second career. So my basic background was a teacher and professionally. Then I turned into an educational entrepreneur, and that was kind of an interesting process, quite by accident, quite unplanned. And that happened because in the late 70s, I got very interested in how a computer could help kids learn, because I was always interested in the fact that kids learn so differently. And it was so silly to me to be having a class of 30 kids and trying to teach them all, you know, when they were all over the place academically. They had different learning styles. They learned at different rates. So they wanted to go in different depths. And I thought, you know, the computer could be a useful learning tool. So we developed some simple programs. I used them tutoring. And pretty soon, a lot of people wanted to buy them. And we started a simple company just basically to sell them to our students. And then people really liked them. And I mean, really, I had no intention of going into business. But my husband kept saying, this could be really big. This could be really big. You should market these a little bit. So we did. And we had the products, Math Blaster, Reading Blaster, and, you know, all those products that Daniel's mother, came in and to the Davidson Fellows Award, she said, Daniel started using these. I think he was about 8 months old or so when he started using Math Blaster and Algebra Blaster and Geometry Blaster. But, you know, not every kid that used those turned out like Daniel. But we had another student this year that solved an unsolvable math problem we gave a Davidson Award to. So then we did that, and after the company did real well, after the first 7 years, I really needed a professional business person to run the company. And I really wanted to just develop the products because I love that part of it. And so I talked my husband into joining the company, and we did real well after we did well when I was there, but he really took us big time. We went public, we did well, and we sold we sold the company, and we decided to put the money in charitable trusts and give it back in some way to education. So after that, Bob and I, after we sold our company, or actually as we were selling our company, we wanted to give money back to education because that was what we knew, that was what we loved, and that was what we cared about. And so we had a lot of ideas on how we could help kids learn. We were always interested in helping kids be successful learners. That's what our software was about. And we just had lots of ideas, as you can imagine, and we investigated all these ideas. And then we started thinking about, well, what group is having trouble learning in school? And of course, we looked at the obvious populations, but we realized when we looked at all the populations that it was the gifted students that were often going to school and not learning and not really developing their full potential. And the more we researched it, the more upset we got. And the more we start... Is that me or is this the machine? The more we got upset about what was going on, and the more we decided that we could use our capital, our human capital, and our financial resources to make a difference. And that's what we set out to do 6.5 years ago. We started the Davidson Institute. So I want you to know that I'm coming from my experience in serving profoundly gifted students at the Davidson Institute. And of course, I've tried to read everything there is to read about gifted education. And of course, I did a lot of research writing the book and just serving these kids. I had to do a lot of research. So I wanted to go through the services real briefly that we offer so you can kind of get a feeling for what kind of experience I've had. We serve, our biggest program that serves the most kids is the Davidson Young Scholars Program, and it's an individualized program. We work really through the parents at whatever the individual child needs for profoundly gifted students. And if the biggest thing they need, and almost with every child, we need to help with finding appropriate educational accommodations, whether they need grade skipping, or they need a different kind of school, are they going to do homeschooling because they can't get accommodations. We work very carefully and closely with the family to help the child get to a situation where he is learning in school, and or at least learning. It's something is exciting his mind or her mind. So that's what we do. Of course, these services are free. That's the biggest thing we do. We also are there to help with social and emotional issues that any child may have. And we do provide financial assistance for any of these things that the child might need. So I'm going to be talking about having a gifted child is having an exceptional child, and it costs more money. So these free services we also do a lot in talent development because some of these kids really get into some subject, whatever it is, we help. If it's nanotechnology, we help them find a mentor at a university or someplace that can help them. Math, we have lots of math mentors because we have lots of math prodigies in the program. We also give them a community where they can be with their intellectual peers because many of them are so bright, they really have no intellectual peers in a time, it's kind of hard to find in a local community. We offer 3 weeks intensive summer program at the University of Nevada at Reno for 12 to 15-year-olds, where they can earn college credit, 12 or 7 college credits in 3 weeks. It's pretty intensive for these kids, but they do it, and they do it well. We mentioned the Davidson Fellows Award, where we try to celebrate achievement, extraordinary achievement, and by offering $50, $25, and $10,000 scholarships, and for completing a significant piece of work that has a positive, that's a positive benefit to society. And our latest thing, which we're just starting and working on right now, is we've had our kids, or the people we serve, and the parents and the students request that we start a school. And so we always said, well, you know, you're all over the country, and we certainly don't want to start a boarding school because we don't want to raise you. You know, we raised our kids. We're too smart to want to raise you. And so many of our parents said, we'll move if you start a school. And so that made us think. And then we started realizing, well, we have lots of very bright kids in Nevada and surrounding areas, and maybe there would be enough kids to start the school. And we also had such encouragement from the University of Nevada, because after our Think Summer program there, the professors really enjoy teaching our students. They like the way we supervise them so closely, and you know, it's just been a good working relationship. So we went to the Nevada State Legislature, only meets every other year for 4 months. And we went and we prepared a piece of legislation. We hired lawyers. We prepared a piece of legislation. We went to the legislature. We aren't politically wired in Nevada. We've only been there 8 years ourselves. We moved from Southern California to, quote, retire at Lake Tahoe. But I never intended to retire. I knew I would do. But Bob kind of retires. He's back at home working on this academy, though. He's busy right now. But so we just went to the legislature. We hired a very good lobbyist. We had very good legislation written. We really researched that. And we got it passed just in the last 20 seconds of the session. It got passed. And we're starting the school next. It's a public school, and we're starting it next fall. Of course, we will provide every child with a completely individualized education. Their needs will be met. This will be a lot of unique programming, and we will clearly heavily subsidize it to be able to provide the kind of education these kids need, because we won't be getting anything the first year from the state, but the second year we will, and that will only cover part of it. So it's a combination of what we were, I think, bringing to the state and that made it all happen. But I'm still kind of amazed it happened. I actually wasn't expecting it to happen, or I wouldn't have continued with this speaking tour. Because I've been on the road for about 3 weeks. One of the things we work really hard at is spreading, while we serve with direct services, the very, you know, what I call the outliers on the curve, the extremely bright kids, that we are trying to address the needs of the whole population. You know, when you study the extreme needs of in any extreme situation, you understand the whole characteristics of the whole population in a less extreme form. But we try to make a lot of information available to the public, to teachers and parents. And so I know that many of you have probably been to our website. We have a section now called GT CyberSource, and it has, we've reorganized the website recently, has article, research articles, lots and lots of them, about 500 of them, a database of research for gifted kids, state policy information, discussion forums, you know, all sorts of information about that of interest, you know, conferences, all these things are in one place, and there's a, the homepage highlights the key new things. So I strongly urge you to go there for information. And if you have ideas, and you can contribute information, you can contribute information to any of these things, there's a means for doing that. There's also a means on our website to email any page to anyone else. So if you have a, if you're reading a great article that you think your teacher would like to read, you just can email it to them, attach a little note, and they have it. And then we have an Educators Guild, which we try to inform educators as much as they can about the needs of gifted learners. And to be fair, as you may, those of you that have read the book, as we discussed in the book, the educators get very little training, if any at all, in gifted education. It's very hard to even get a master's degree in gifted education. There's a handful of schools that do, that have it and have a good, do a good job, do a great job. But there's, well, the bet most, the highest, the largest teacher producing schools at most have a chapter in a special ed book. That's the most they offer in gifted education, the most we could find that they would offer. So maybe those educator students in the School of Education getting their teacher certification, maybe they'll read a chapter in a book. Maybe it might, they might have one class on gifted education. And I'm telling you, very often, in at least in our state, we're the ones that teach that class. We get to teach the one-hour class to those teachers because the university, both major universities call on us to do that. So there's very little education for teachers. So we have to bring things to their attention as both as parents, and that's the purpose of the Educators Guild, to bring a lot of information. So if you want your teacher to be better informed, encourage them to join the Educators Guild. The points I like to make in this presentation is to talk about how to help you think about your gifted child as an exceptional child with exceptional learning needs. It looks like I have a typo there. Excuse me. And there's a critical need for gifted children to have the opportunity to learn in school. They must have an opportunity to learn in school. And I also want to offer some cost-effective strategies, which I've been suggesting in my meetings today, for meeting the needs of gifted learners, and suggestions on how parents and educators can work together to help schools implement these strategies. The best gifted programs I've seen throughout the country are when parents and educators work together in a collaborative way to do what is best for the kids. Not when parents just advocate for their own kid. When parents realize that what they're doing is working for all kids, all gifted kids, and teachers, you know, we're working for the whole group, that's when it works the best. So let's look at gifted kids as exceptional learners. Now, oops, sorry, didn't mean to do that. So the basic, this is the statistical bell curve, but the basic curriculum is addressed to deal with the kids, the kids that fall in within the normal, quote, normal range. That's one standard deviation above and below the mean of 100. Gifted, that's where the majority of the population falls. And then the rest of the population falls about, so basically this is, what is, 68.26%. I prefer just to round it up to, most of the population falls in the middle, that's 70%. In our federal dollars, because every state's different, you can never figure out the state dollars, but for every federal dollar we spend on gifted education, the 70% in the for the 70% in the middle, 80 cents of each federal dollar is spent in that middle range, a standard deviation above and below the 100. For the rest of the rest at the far end, here's your gifted end. This is roughly 30%, 15%, and this is roughly 15%. For federal dollars, this section, the learning disability section, those kids, the 20 cents of the federal dollar goes to those special needs kids. And obviously, they have to have individual plans, and their needs are of such an extent that it is going to cost more dollars to serve their needs than it will be to serve the gifted. But should something be given to the gifted? Didn't I say 80 cents and 20 cents? Is anything going to the gifted? A third of a penny in federal dollars goes to serve the needs of the gifted. Now, why is that? I'm assuming that there is this huge notion that gifted kids can fend for themselves, and that talent is going to be developed just automatically because you're smart. Well, let me tell you, because you're smart does not make you talented. You've got to develop talent. Because you're smart, you can't be left to fend to yourself. Being smart does not make you wise. So, what you need to have happen is recognize that's one point. Now, the next point I want to make with the bell curve is that all these kids... I'm sorry, I'm having trouble getting my arrow. Okay. All these kids over here in the gifted range, what do you observe about them? Not only aren't there not very many of them, I mean, they decline, but there's how many standard deviations? And then they go beyond this chart, they can go on out here. We don't know how to measure, really. We don't have any good instruments to measure above 145. But they can, you know, I call these out here the outliers. So we have a wide variation of gifted students. So when I go to all these school districts and they say, the first thing I say when I come, here's what we do for gifted. And it's one thing for gifted. And that gifted is a wide range of abilities. There's a wider range of abilities in the gifted range than there is in the normal range. So we need to think of gifted as really these kids, just like the kids in the special needs group, these kids are very much in need of an individualized program based on where they are along this curve and what their needs are. And there's not one size fits all. Now, the big fad, and I heard it some of it today, that we differentiate in the regular classroom. And we serve the regular kids and the gifted kids. So we serve how many standard deviations here? You know, I mean, it's pretty hard to do. It's impossible. It's impossible to do it well. You might have a class of gifted students and differentiate, but you still are going to have kids out there, the outlier kids, that aren't going to be served in that gifted class. We see it all the time. But you still have to differentiate a great deal in a class of similars. In a regular class where you have two standard deviations that you're dealing with, you still have to differentiate to serve those kids. So this idea that you can differentiate and include all kids along the scale is not a very practical idea unless you have superheroes as your teachers. So I've never found that solution very satisfactory. I've always found it as an excuse and not a very good one for serving gifted learners. Okay. Now let's talk about these exceptional gifted learners that are out there, and let's talk about how they're thinking. If you have a good mind, if you're good at anything, let's forget a good mind. If you're good at anything, you get great pleasure out of doing that thing you're good at well. If you're good at athletics, you're good at doing whatever your sport is well. We can understand that. If you're good at making cherry pie, you get a lot of pride. I make a very good cherry pie, wouldn't you know? My children come home for my cherry pie. It's hard to get your children home when they go away, so you need to have these skills. I get great pleasure out of doing that well and drawing my kids home, especially when they have grandchildren. I have two of those now. I just had one 3 weeks ago today. So, 3 weeks ago yesterday. Anyway, so when you do something well, you want to do it more and you want to do it better and better because you like to achieve. And if a kid thinks well, he wants or she wants to use his or her brain. He or she gets great pleasure out of solving complex problems. And if they're put in a classroom and denied that ability, they're very frustrated. They're in great pain. They don't get the joy of developing something they have the raw talent to develop. And it's painful. It's very painful. These very bright kids are going to stand out from their age peers. Many of them, not all of them. Some of them are bright socially and they pick up social clues very well, cues very well, and dumb down. But some are going to stand out from their age peers and they're going to appear different. Bright children may be teased or tormented for making out of the ordinary comments, for being quirky, for being different, for being weird. How many of you have ever been called weird? Yeah. Because you're thinking a little differently and it sounds funny to a kid that's thinking, you know, in the normal range. You have this idea that seems quirky. And so people think you're weird for being different. And developing satisfactory friendships for very bright children is especially difficult when they're forced to associate with age peers who think differently. Because, you know, our friendships, we develop by our connection with people. And how do we mostly connect with people? By talking to them. And if we're talking on one level and another person is talking at another level, whether it's here or here, it's hard to connect with them. So it's difficult when you force a very bright child to who's above academically, who's to stay with his age peers or her age peers when they don't have a lot in common to talk about in the classroom. And especially in the early years, intellectual development is often out of sync with emotional and physical development. But social development. Many of these kids can socialize with older kids in a way because they can communicate at an older level. And so many parents worry about, oh my goodness, Johnny has so many older friends. I don't think that's good. And you know, my mother worried all my childhood that I had older friends. I don't know what she thought they were going to do, but because, you know, I lived in a little rural community and it was, you know, they were just friends. But she'd always say, can't you have some friends your own age? Well, I didn't know why I didn't like kids my own age, but I just was more comfortable with the older kids. And it was just such a big issue. And today when I was talking about the teachers about grade skipping, and you know, it's such a big issue that these kids aren't going to be socially well adjusted if they aren't in with their age group. And that's just not the case. Because if they're thinking at a higher level, they're going to be limited into what they can communicate with their age peers anyway. And they're going to feel weird. Many of these kids are more sensitive than other children. They think more abstractly earlier. So as Marika Gross was explaining to us in one of our trainings at the Institute, that when these kids, like at 1 year old, they'll be thinking of abstract things. They'll understand, they'll have questions about God or a supreme being. They'll have an idea about what love is. They'll think about what love is. They'll think about friendship and how friendship meant commitment and you know, all that kind of stuff. And then they go to school and they think they have a friend because she asked to play with them on the playground. And then the next day, the friend says, you're weird. I don't want to play with you. And the child is crushed because her idea of friendship is something not to play on the playground, but something everlasting. And that's not where her little friend is, because her little friend isn't thinking about everlasting nature of friendship. It's very hard for them to connect with kids their age peers if they're at an abstract level far beyond. Numerous studies have found the highly gifted students tend to be more socially and emotionally mature than their age peers, particularly during the adolescent and teen years. Because, you know, the adolescents, teens do lots of silly things. Kids, not that they don't do silly things, they just are just a little more mature than the others, for the most part, not every bright kid. So for parents, I've been trying to emphasize you have an exceptional child. And I've tried to show you with the bell curve and try to emphasize that. So get over being normal. Because you're kind of doing the same thing everyone else does. You kind of think, well, the smart kid can fit in here and here and just be with everybody else. So if you don't understand that your child is exceptional, you're kind of doing the same thing, you know, because if you have a learning disabled child, it's more obvious. But when you have a very bright child, you like to think they're bright and smart, but they're just still normal. Just get over being normal. You have an exceptional child. You're raising an exceptional child. Raising an exceptional child means you have to do exceptional things. You don't have the normal trajectory. And your kid meets the milestones differently earlier and all that than other kids. So you have to adjust what you thought you were getting into when you conceived that kid, if you were thinking about it. Yeah, I knew I was going to get in trouble there. Takes more work. It takes more work to have an exceptional child. It's more challenging. It requires more flexibility, more originality, more creativity. It costs more money. It does. It just costs more money to raise any exceptional child. It takes more time. It requires more patience, especially if they ask questions constantly. And it has its special joys and rewards, like raising any child does. Sometimes you have to look for them longer. No. They do. They have their challenges, too. So, how do you approach a parenting a gifted child? Well, one thing I would do, I highly recommend, is that you get an assessment of where the child is. Now, a lot of parents say, I don't need an IQ number. Well, if you, that's fine. Don't get the number, but understand at what level the child is, so you know what sorts of accommodations you're going to need for the child. Depending on when the child gets identified or when you come to terms that you've got a very gifted child, the child may have decided to dumb down, may be acting out, may be demonstrating all sorts of other characteristics. So you need to find out what you're dealing with. Many extremely bright children are what we call twice exceptional. They have a learning disability or they have some other disability while they're gifted, and they mask each other out. So they might appear like they're normal, but a kid might be dyslexic and very bright, but it cancels each other out. He's able to hide the fact that he has difficulty or she has difficulty reading, whatever. So you need to get a nice assessment that gives you a real picture, and maybe it will show that there may be a disability involved, and you get this, you know, you can learn all this at this point. We have an article that we get so many questions about this. I am not an expert on testing and assessment, not at all, so don't ask me any questions about it afterwards. I have people in our office I can direct you to if you want questions. There's certainly people at Wickedy, ask them. But we have an article on GT CyberSource just to answer the main questions we get about that. And then learn all you can about giftedness. Read all the articles. You start seeing things that, oh, that's what that is. And it will be helpful. The more you understand, the better you'll be able to parent. And there's a lot of parenting strategies we have on there. How to deal with teachers that don't understand. How to deal with a kid that's becoming an extreme perfectionist, an unhealthy perfectionist, for one reason, because he's not or she's not being challenged in school. My basic parenting advice is to provide your gifted child a home where he is safe or she is safe and comfortable for who he or she is. Because gifted children, especially if they aren't accommodated, don't feel safe. They're bullied, teased, they're sensitive and they feel out of place in school. They aren't learning. They're frustrated. They may be depressed. Home is their safe haven. And they may not want to go to school. They may not want to go out with certain kids and, you know, try to respect and work with that because they're feeling some pain. So your child needs to be comfortable with home. No one in the family should be teasing that child or abusing that child in any even subtle way that to make them feel different, odd, weird, all that. A home should be where each child is loved for who she is, not what she can do. Make sure that you don't praise in such a way that, you know, I love you because you're smart. You know, I just love you for each child in this family for who they are. And when each child's uniqueness is treasured and recognized. What's happening in our schools today? Well, the vast majority of gifted students are provided a little more than the standard curriculum. And being under challenge denies gifted children the joy of achievement, as well as the necessary skills to struggle through a problem and solve it. You know, it's being able to achieve something is a wonderful thing. And it's very hard to never be able to achieve something until you're an adult. And maybe then you'll be so tuned out, or you'll be so frustrated, you'll never achieve. But we need to let these kids have an opportunity to excel and achieve, particularly in the area they're so strong at, which is in using their minds, which means in school. Highly gifted students are the most likely students to fall through the cracks in American classrooms. They are the ones experiencing the greatest gaps between their potential and what is being asked of them. And that's wrong. It is absolutely wrong. And that's why I spend so much time advocating for this. Oh, this is my federal law. So what are the consequences if we let this go on and we let teachers give lip service to gifted kids, or I can address them in my classroom by differentiation and da-da-da. Some become depressed. Some become unhealthy perfectionists, and they're so used to being perfect that when they don't ever get challenged, and when they suddenly get in a situation in adulthood or at college where there's other people that can do it, and they suddenly don't have the skills to put together some paper or do something hard, they panic. They drop out of college, or worse. Some act out. Some pursue dangerous behaviors to drive the boredom away. And pursuing dangerous behaviors is a really serious thing. That in itself is a ruin, is a serious reason for parents to address this and schools to address this early, but they just don't seem to feel the need. And then some drop out. Do you know 20% of our gifted students, 20% of our dropouts test in the gifted range? And statistically, 5% of our students are gifted. Our nation suffers as well. We are at a shortage in this country in engineers, scientists, computer scientists, mathematicians. We are producing fewer than we need, and we aren't able to attract as many from other countries as we were, because China and India are catching up. They're producing, they're providing entrepreneurial environments where these people can soar. People would rather go to the Indian Institute for Technology. MIT is their second choice if they don't get in. It's true. We aren't attracting the talent that we were. And this is going to be the next big thing that is going to be the crisis. And if there is this crisis, there is the crisis. America hasn't awakened to it. It's not publicly known. It's publicly known, but it's not in the press yet. But it will be. And we are going to need more educated people, and we're going to have to do different things to educate our brightest children. And people will stop talking about differentiation in the regular classroom when that happens. But we have children in school today, and we need to address their needs now. So what we want is to give every child an opportunity to learn to the full extent of their abilities. Every child. Not just the gifted. But I'm focusing on the gifted because we found that the gifted kids were the ones that weren't given that opportunity in school. So what can schools do? The first thing we hear, of course, I hear every place, is we don't have any money to help. serve gifted kids. So I decided I better come up with some cost-effective way to serve gifted kids, because no one wants to spend any money on gifted kids at this moment. So here's what we can do. I've got 12 cost-effective ways to serve gifted kids. It's not going to cost schools any more money, school districts any more money. Okay. The first one is early entrance to kindergarten. Did you ever understand why there was a cutoff date? If you were one day over, you couldn't get in. And if you were one day younger, you could get in kindergarten. And they have a screening test to see if you're ready. If a child can pass the screening test, don't you think they ought to be able to get in kindergarten? The readiness test for kindergarten. It's not going to cost the state more money. They're just going to still move through and graduate, not take up any more money. If a child enters kindergarten and can read, that is an ideal time to go ahead and let that child go to first grade. There's no big stigma there's no need to make the child sit through and learn the sounds of letters. So this is a very good time to look at identifying bright children. Now, you don't need to necessarily give them tests. You can observe what they can do. If they're advanced, maybe they should be in the next grade. And consider that. Pre-assessments. This is one that Marika Gross. Marika Gross is one of my mentors because she studied the highly gifted so well. And her work has been mostly done in Sydney, Australia, although she went to Purdue University too. For her graduate work. But America's biggest thing when she talks to teachers and kids and parents, she's in schools and working to serve gifted kids, why don't you give a pre-assessment before any unit or any class, any course, depending on where you are, what age group. And if that child or student has mastery of that material, let that child do something else. Don't make that child sit through the material, sit through a course that he already has mastered or she has already mastered. So pre-assessment's done before unit, and if mastery's done, now I'm not talking about perfect mastery. What would be mastery to pass the course? If the student has mastered the material, then go on to something else or give the student a different project that would go deeper or whatever. But do something else. Don't make the child sit through and be bored through the class. The self-contained classes for the gifted, particularly in core curriculum subjects, are highly effective. And it's even better in many ways, if it's to accommodate to make a larger class, to have multi-age self-contained classes for gifted students and allow them to work at a pace, a faster pace, and a deeper and in greater depth. Now, let me talk about skill-based or ability-based groupings. Skill-based groupings of students are the most effective for skill levels with regards to academic achievement. And are the most effective groupings for all skill levels with regards to academic achievement. Let me say that again, because there's a lot of false information out there. There's a lot of people in education that feel that's wrong, but it's not. Skill-based groupings of students are more effective for all skill levels with regard to academic achievement. So if the school's priority is academic achievement, they ought to be considering skill-based groupings of students. The same is true for social and emotional development. Children develop a self-concept by comparing themselves to others, and they by comparing themselves to those around them. And if they can see, well, I can do this better than Johnny, but he can do that better than me or Susie, whatever, you know, that I'm in here. But if someone's way above me or way below me, I have a distorted view of who I am and my abilities. Let me go back here. Okay. Well, this research was done by James Kulik, and I've got the resources at the back here, who is a researcher at the University of Michigan. Now I know that, and what he does is he evaluates educational research. And he evaluated numerous studies on groupings, and he identified the studies that were the most thorough and with the most techniques, and then studies that included gifted students. Not only gifted students, that included all levels of students, but that meant included the high levels of students. And he evaluated those, and these were his conclusions from the study. It's well documented by James Kulik at the University of Michigan, a researcher of educational research who does this meta-analysis. So that's our four things I just covered that you can do. Subject acceleration. Now I'm going to talk about acceleration and the research on acceleration. The next thing I want to talk about is subject acceleration. It is to be encouraged when a student is proficient in a particular subject. Grade acceleration should be encouraged when a student demonstrates proficiency at a particular grade level. These things do not cost the district any more money. They cost maybe more administrative time, but they're worth it for the kids. Opportunities for dual enrollment are available to students, for example, taking a high school course. When a student is middle school, that option should be available. Going to college and high school at the same time for different courses, or skipping high school altogether and going to college. And that should be an option, and can be an option too. And we've shown with AP and IB programs, the Advanced Placement International Baccalaureates, in the last 10 years, we've shown that high school students can easily do college work. Not easily, but can do college work. They're challenged, but they can do it. And they can do it reasonably well and get the credit, or at least earn the credits. Sometimes some colleges, of course, don't give it to them, particularly if you're going to an Ivy League, but they know they've accomplished something. They have that knowledge. So acceleration is something that works, and we should consider. There was a major report out on the Templeton report, and I've got a couple of them out there on the table, and I suggest you read it. It's free. It's downloadable. I suggest you give it to your teachers. But acceleration is very effective, and here's some of the grade acceleration work. Now, grade acceleration is highly effective intervention if it's appropriately evaluated and monitored. When properly handled, grade acceleration does not result in social and emotional issues. But you have to properly handle it. You have to clearly evaluate it, and you have to monitor it after it takes place. And I'm going to talk to you about, and this is how I recommend you evaluate it, that you use the Iowa Acceleration Scale developed at the University of Iowa Bell and Blank Center. And you use it to evaluate whether acceleration is the right solution. And if it is, then you go forward with the acceleration. And these are the findings from The Nation Deceived. The research is very strong. Students that accelerate achieve more, they're better adjusted, they are this it's much better than leaving them stuck in a classroom where they aren't learning. It's much better for them. Now, sometimes parents feel that, oh, I like Johnny or Jane to make all A's so she or he can go to Harvard. But Harvard will recognize that you've been accelerated too. And there should be more than going to Harvard. There should be, is that child learning? It is painful to the child not to be learning in school. And if he isn't learning, you really need to consider an acceleration. We use acceleration all the time. I mean, all the time by, I mean, probably 3/4 of our students have accelerated. And we've managed the project, we've processed, we've used this Iowa Acceleration Scale. It is very effective. And these are the resources on acceleration right here. I also like Karen Rogers' Reforming Gifted Education book. I like Susan Esseling's book from Developing Mathematical Talent and the Iowa Acceleration Scale. I also think we need to be sure that counselors understand talent development and understand that gifted kids need to learn in school. And need to understand how to encourage and find other opportunities, particularly the services offered by WICCDE. Teachers and counselors need to know that those services are there and be able to offer them. They need to work with the talent searchers like WICCDE and take courses. I would encourage the school districts to work with WICCDE on the distance learning program, the co-op program they have, to do the distance learning courses for extra or additional courses for acceleration right in the school. And to create a school culture that values intellectual discovery and achievement, where students are encouraged to accomplish more than they would, more with together than they would alone. And administrators and teachers who are flexible in addressing individual needs. When we work with schools to advocate for a student, if the school is flexible and focused on doing what is best for the kids, we can usually work out good accommodations. If the school is just rigid, we can't do this, we can't do that, you know, we don't, our policy is we don't believe in acceleration. Well, do you read the research? You know, I mean, it's not a matter of belief. It's a matter of what the research says. So if we're going to effect change, I've given you some simple, not simple, I've given you some cost-effective ways you can do it. I plead with you to not let your children waste away in school. I spent a lot of time as a parent myself not wanting to be a pushy parent. And I'm probably out here doing this because I regret that. I had a child who had an unhealthy perfectionist. And, you know, we had a lot of struggles that if those kids had been challenged in school, life would have been a lot better for them and better for the family. Advocacy groups working with schools do wonderful things. The best programs I've seen have been done with that collaboration. I like to encourage anytime you want to accomplish something that you have fixed goal and flexible strategy. Your goal is for your child, is for gifted kids, for all children to learn in school. That's your goal. And there'll be lots of different ways you'll have to go around to get there. Be flexible with your strategies. And, you know, when one strategy doesn't work, you know, you do the other one. I found in business and in life in general, people kind of fall in love with their strategies for tackling the problem, and it becomes their goal, when it's the goal that's important. The goal is the only thing fixed. Strategies, you can change those. Figure out the politics. I've never been particularly good about that, but life's easier if you've got it figured out. But together you can all pull your information and figure it out. Practice your pitches. Oh, learn to negotiate. I know parent groups that spend time with a negotiator, and they help each other advocate for their children and get services. Practice your pitches, refine your arguments, respect educators for the caring professionals they are, because I've never known an educator who felt they were doing the wrong thing. They believe they are doing the right thing. And it's just a matter of helping them understand a different way of thinking about the situation. I tried to do that today. I may have made a little progress. I didn't make a lot of progress. Respect educators' time. Make appointments. Come in. Be to the point briefly. Send a thank you note for their time. Be gracious. Be pleasantly persistent. If you can be persistent, but be pleasantly persistent. If you're in a bad mood, if you're frustrated, if you're angry, call someone in your parent group. Don't call the educator. Okay? It's not the time to deal with educators when you're frustrated. And follow up. Be pleasantly persistent. Follow up a meeting with a thank you letter or note. When you treat people with respect, and you know, they'll be respectful to you. And, you know, I did get the message today that some teachers thought certain parents pushed too hard for their kids. I mean, that's not really an unusual thought on teachers' part for gifted parents, but I'm just saying, just make sure you take your position and you back it up with research and data, and you know, just good, solid evidence. Not just power and pushiness. I say in the book, the kids we've been involved with, the kids are pushing their parents. It's not the parents being the pushy one. And realize it's a long-term effort. And be willing to say, I'm going to work at this, even though my kids may be graduated by the time the program's in place. This is your philanthropic effort. It's not just for your kids. It's for all kids. All kids should learn in school. So, that's just my recap. Remember, you have an exceptional child. You're parenting an exceptional child. With exceptional learning needs, you may have to think differently about things. It's critical for you to have the opportunity for your children to have and for your child to have an opportunity to learn to the full extent of his or her ability. Make sure he is learning or she is learning in school. If she's not, you've got to figure out some way to challenge that child. Maybe you do it outside of school. It's a good short-term solution. Get the child interested in something else. And we spend a lot of time talking in one group with teachers about mentors, the benefit of mentors. It's a wonderful resource. It's something that can inspire and take a kid far. There are cost-effective strategies for schools. So when you hear you can't afford it, you've got some cost-effective strategies. These slides will be up on the Genius Denied website probably by the end of this week. If I can have time to get online, I'll send them back and have them converted to a PDF file, and you can download them. And It will be under in giftedgeniusdenied.com under book tour. And parents and educators can work together to affect positive change, but they have to be partners, collaborators in solving a problem. They can't be, you know, two sides. And when you have collaboration solving a problem, you get better, you come up with better solutions anyway. I want to real quickly tell you the story of Brennan Johnson, who was a young lady who was born on an Iowa hog farm, and her parents struggled to keep the farm going. And she had, I think, three brothers, and this is in the first chapter of our book, really enjoyed the life on the farm, but the good life on the farm, even though they were poor, didn't last too much after she was in third grade, I think, because her parents divorced. And then the resources, then they had to give up the farm, and the resources were very limited, and they both had to work in factory jobs. And Brennan was very smart, but she never fit in school. And her accommodations, when they found out how smart she was to sit in the back of the room with an advanced math course and work on her own. And she didn't want to be smart, so she just didn't do the work, and so she could be like the other kids, because she was very poor. She had to be on food stamps. She was African American. She felt different in a rural community where most of the people were white. So she just, dumbed down, and so she could be as much like the other kids as possible. But fortunately, Brennan's mother had the good fortune of getting a factory job in Des Moines, Iowa. And Des Moines, Iowa has a school within a school, I think it is, Central School in the middle, and it's a school for gifted students. And every gifted student gets to soar as far as they want to go. Well, they identified Brennan. As soon as she came into the district, that she was very bright, they let her go through school very quickly. Grades weren't a big deal. You just, grades are kind of this administrative convenience. It's not, you don't need grades. Grade levels. I don't mean evaluations. I think you need evaluations, but you don't need these grade levels. You have to be in a certain grade level. So they let her accelerate and move through school at her pace and depth. And when finally she finished all the science courses, so she got to work with a mentor, and she got on a project and somehow discovered a new subspecies of the hognose snake. And she got to write up her paper and how she did it and present it with the professor at some big conference on some snakes, I guess. I've never been to such a conference on snakes, but anyway, they're quite different, I'm sure, than gifted conferences. But she then heard about the Davidson Fellows and applied for the Davidson Fellows and won a $50,000 award. And her goal was to get as far away from Iowa as she could. She's at Columbia University now in some field of science that I probably can't even pronounce. I don't even remember it. But she won a $50,000 scholarship. And there she is with Senator Grassley. And the reason I want to tell this story is very often these kids achieve great things, have parents there supporting them, helping them find mentors, and so on. Brennan had none of this. Her parents could barely put food on the table. But she had a school that let her learn, and that made all the difference in her life. So, I'd like to leave you with the parting words from John F. Kennedy. Not every child has an equal talent or an equal ability or an equal motivation. But children have the equal right to develop their talent, their ability, and their motivation. Thank you very much. Thank you.
As Latino youth, one of the things that really bothers me is when people assume that I have bad grades just because I'm Latino.
My grades are good. I have 5 A's and 4 B's.
I have straight A's.
My grades are pretty good. I mean, I'm an AB student.
My grades are usually A's and B's.
I'm an A and B student.
As a Latino youth, one of the things that really bothers me is racial slurs.
I think they do that to degrade other people and make themselves feel better.
Because they don't know about their race and how they really are.
Because they don't know the culture and they don't know the tradition.
Like when people are fighting and whatnot, they're always saying stuff about each other. And then it usually gets down to racial slurs and whatnot, and it doesn't make sense. Like, why do you got to bring people's race into it? We all the same people. We all have feelings. We all cry. What makes them different?
As Latino youth, one of the things that really bothers me is when people assume that just because I'm Latino, I'm from Mexico.
I was born in Asunción, Paraguay.
I was born in the United States, and my parents are from Mexico.
And I was born and raised here, but my parents aren't from Mexico. They're from El Salvador.
I'm from the United States. My parents are from the United States. My grandma's from the United States. My grandpa's from Mexico.
Oh, this is Ivan Pierre Abaca. He's third generation Puerto Rican American.
My name is Rhonda Sterling, and I'll be your host tonight for The Tardy Zone. Donnie DeLay had potential. He was smart, creative, and a popular guy. That is, up until he discovered PlayStation 2. It consumed him. He began to forget things, such as doing his homework, setting his alarm clock, and therefore being on time. He's fallen into The Tardy Zone.
Look at this mess. Where's the Johnson file?
Hold on. I had it. I just had it a couple minutes ago. Hold on. I can get it.
Not on my desk by Friday. You're fired!
Bad habits that develop in youth follow you throughout your whole life. Think of Johnny's fate. Don't find yourself in the Tardy Zone.
That's apostrophe news, short for student news.
Snooze is a new show about the goings-on of students in the Madison Metropolitan School District. And what's really cool is the students do much of the cam work and interviews.
Hi, I'm Hector from James C. Wright Middle School.
And I'm Max from James C. Wright Middle School. We're going to be your snooze host. So stay tuned to snooze, and snooze you won't. We begin this snooze on location at the ringside of the Action Pack Snooze Chess Tournament.
Thanks, guys. We're here at the ringside of the Action Pack First Annual Snooze Bowl Chess Tournament. Behind me is a game between 11th grade Eric and 6-year-old Brian. Let's see how they're doing.
Now, next door, we'll see a lot of people working together to show their pride in their neighborhood with a very unique art project.
Let me guess, they made a quilt?
No, not a quilt.
They made a sculpture of an old statue out of an old tree?
No, there's already one of those in Madison.
I give up. What is it?
Snooze reporter Hannah has the rest of the story.
Hi, I'm Hannah. I'm in fourth grade and I go to Falk Elementary School. One art class we came in and Miss Link introduced us to this man named Mr. Grover. He was going to help us make a statue for our neighborhood.
So this is a picture.
Wow, that was cool. A big sign made out of concrete and ceramic leaves.
Can you imagine making something that would be shown for years to come? Well, this brings us to the end of this edition of Snooze. Once again, I'm Lucretia Dixon from Center Middle School.
And I'm Vanessa Frank from Center Middle School.
From Girl Neighborhood Power.
Thanks for watching Snooze.
Didn't start this way. Don't steal.
Wow, she is so cool.
Yeah, no, I want to be just like her.
Barbie, let's go party.
This is how dumb it looks when you try to be someone else.
Bullies cause trouble for no reason.
Bullies are insecure. The only way a bully gets close to someone is by fighting.
Bullies always end up lonely.
People are always telling me to get more sleep. I don't know what they're talking about. I mean, I don't need sleep to pay attention. I mean, I go to bed or I never fail the class, so they should just mind their own business. Ow, watch where you're going. Hurt. Oh, I need to get home to play my video game and get and beat level 15. I'm a fully functioning human being. I don't need sleep. People should just get off my tapes.
Score.
Required as MSCR provides training. Call 204-3027 to reserve space at an orientation.
Crawford driving.
Ball goes out of bounds, though. It'll belong to Blackhawk with 42.1 seconds left. A little pressure being applied in the backcourt. Sullivan has it down hard on the floor as Durkin. Ball comes ahead to Russ. Russ has shut us up and in.
You know, there are many types of creative activities like this throughout our district, which really get kids engaged in school. For example, one of the things that Amber and I have been involved in for the last 3 years is video production for the cable TV show you're watching right now, Snooze.
Since we were freshmen, we've covered many stories and have been involved in many different facets of the production of this show. We've operated the camera from time to time, we've conducted interviews, we've even directed 3 camera shoots.
And we've been in front of the camera a lot, too.
And we got to work with kids from different high schools.
Well, Madison, excuse me?
Which was definitely fun.
But this is the first time we've been Snooze hosts.
You know, this is kind of turning into a retrospective on the high school video career of Amber and Amanda.
Well, after all, we are seniors now, and we aren't going to be around next year, and our viewers are going to miss us. If we don't do an Amber and Amanda student video career tribute, who will? Besides, it's to make a good point, and that is, if you're interested in getting involved in video production, there are many opportunities throughout our school district, and Snooze is one of them. Let's go behind the scenes and show our viewers what Gavin and David get to do today.
I'm David from Hamilton, and I'm running teleprompter.
See how the script appears on the screen?
Hi, I'm Gavin, and I got to direct today.
I got involved in this because I took video production for MSCR summer enrichment class, and I really liked it. I actually took it 2 years in a row. One of the things I did in summer enrichment video production was learn how to make public service announcements.
Get rid of it. Just throw it in the trash can. You don't want your earth to turn into this.
Functioning human being. I don't need sleep. People should just...
Summer enrichment is a great way for kids to begin learning how to make videos.
We're also involved in our school's video club, sponsored by MSCR. Check it out. Many schools now have video clubs after school. It's really fun and you learn a lot.
We're now in the process of starting an MSCR-sponsored video club at East High School. And LaFollette and West both have video production courses. If you have questions about getting involved in Snooze or other video production opportunities, call the number on your screen.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. I'm Amber from East.
I'm Amanda from East.
And I'm Gavin from Hamilton.
And I'm David also from Hamilton.
Thanks for watching Snooze.